Kalorama, a Recorded Books Highbridge imprint, presents A Second Chance. A Federal Judge Decides Who Deserves It by Frederick Bloch. Read by Joe Barrett. Introduction. I am a federal judge. On June 2, 2023, I let a murderer serving a lifetime sentence out of jail. Instead of dying in prison, he was now a free man. The next day, I was vilified on the front page of the New York Daily News. I subsequently led other condemned men serving lifetime sentences out of jail. Why did I do that? Was it time for me, after serving 29 years as a judge, to retire? Or was it the right thing to do? A few years ago, Congress enacted a bipartisan sentencing reform bill called the First Step Act. Among its sweeping provisions was one allowing a federal district judge, like me, to reconsider the appropriateness of a previously imposed sentence and to reduce that sentence, even if the original sentence was lawful. The act went so far as to allow the judge to nullify a lifetime sentence and grant the prisoner his freedom, as I have done. Never had such power been granted to a federal judge. As of January 2024, 4,680 federal inmates have been released by federal district judges since the Act's creation. There will be many more by the time this book is published. It has changed the whole concept and landscape of sentencing in the federal courts, recognizing that condemned prisoners may be entitled to a second chance, and it has motivated me to write this book. The United States has the largest prison population percentage-wise of any country in the world. It has about 4% of the world's population, but around 22% of the world's inmates. About 1.9 million people out of the current U.S. population of about 330 million are incarcerated. The alumni population is, of course, much larger. An August 2021 article in the Harvard Political Review reported that each year, more than 600,000 individuals are released from state and federal prisons, and another 9 million are released from local jails. It costs us over $80 billion a year to jail this population and to supervise former inmates when they are on post-incarceration supervised release. More shocking, as the article reports, within 3 years of their release, two out of three former prisoners are rearrested, and more than 50% are incarcerated again. But according to a report from the Sentencing Project, a nonpartisan Washington, D.C.-based research and advocacy center, over a three-year period after the First Step Act was enacted, the recidivism rate among those released from prison as a result of the act was only 12%, compared with 45% for the general prison population. On March 14, 2023, the Prison Policy Initiative, an independent research and national criminal justice reform advocacy organization, reported that at least 113 million adults in the U.S., roughly 45%, have a family member who has been incarcerated, and 79 million people have a criminal record, revealing the ripple effects of locking up millions of people every day. The report also confirmed that people of color, who face much greater rates of poverty, are dramatically overrepresented in the nation's prisons and jails. Although books have been written by criminologists, sociologists, and psychologists explaining the reasons for this, the stark reality, as the report points out, is that black Americans make up 38% of the incarcerated population, although they represent only 12% of U.S. residents. We truly have a mass incarceration problem. But most of the jail population comes from the states. Federal prisoners constitute about 200,000 of the inmates, or roughly 10% of our total prison population. State prisons and local jails house the other roughly 90%, and currently only a handful of states, including California, Colorado, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and Ohio, and the District of Columbia, allow prisoners to petition a state court judge for release under limited circumstances. However, there has been some minimum momentum to pass second-look bills in the states, and as of writing, some states, including New York, are considering enacting legislation. The idea of letting a criminal out of jail before his full sentence has been served is politically charged. Arkansas Republican Senator Tom Cotton has blamed the First Step Act for making America less safe. He believes that, if anything, we have an under-incarceration problem and has referred to the First Step Act as criminal leniency legislation. Former Vice President Mike Pence believes that now more than ever we ought to be thinking about how we make penalties tougher on people that are victimizing families in this country. And Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, who sought the Republican nomination for president, had called the act basically a jailbreak bill that has allowed dangerous people out of prison. If he had become president, one of the first things he would have done was to go to Congress and seek the repeal of the First Step Act. I am a huge supporter of the First Step Act's reforms. So is Justice Neil Gorsuch of the United States Supreme Court, who in a recent dissent wrote that the First Step Act may be the most significant criminal justice reform bill in a generation. I especially embrace that part of the act that gives me the discretion to reconsider a previously imposed sentence. I believe in the biblical concept of redemption, and that the First Step Act appropriately provides a path to allow a worthy prisoner a second chance to live a law-abiding life. But what about the roughly 90% of the prison and jail population serving state sentences? Logic dictates that they should also be given the same opportunity at a second chance that the First Step Act now gives the federal prisoner. But as we shall see, they are not. I argue in this book that the states should follow the federal lead and enact legislation similar to the First Step Act. I'm often asked to explain the differences between criminal cases that are handled in federal courts and those that are tried in state courts. Under the 10th Amendment, each state has the power to enact its own criminal laws and to mete out punishment to those who violate those state laws. The laws run the gamut from domestic violence to murder, but the crimes must be committed within the state. They are called intrastate crimes. By contrast, Congress decides which acts constitute federal crimes. If they cross state lines, they are known as interstate crimes. For example, a murder committed solely within a state under a state's murder statute can be prosecuted only in that particular state. But if the murder is an aid of racketeering, which often traverses state boundaries, it can be prosecuted in federal court. The same is true of drug and gun crimes. Congress has declared that drugs travel in interstate commerce, and guns invariably have components manufactured in different states. In addition, some crimes are purely federal. If a federal officer were murdered, that would be a federal crime. Other examples of interstate federal crimes include terrorism, bank robbery, federal income tax evasion, mail and wire fraud, and possession, receipt, or promotion via the Internet of child pornography. Of course, a crime can be both a federal and a state crime. For example, states have their own drug laws that often mirror the federal drug laws. In those cases, the federal and state prosecutors, where the crime has been committed, will usually meet and decide whether the crime will be prosecuted in state or federal court. The feds have the first option. They will decide if the crime is sufficiently serious that it should be federalized. It makes a big difference, because federal penalties are invariably higher than state penalties. Recent statistics released by the National Center for Drug Abuse revealed that 46% of prisoners in federal prison and 26% of women and 13% of men in state prisons are there for drug-related crimes. Approximately 57% of people incarcerated in state prisons and 77% of people incarcerated in federal prison for drug offenses are Black or Latino, while those two groups together account for only a little over 30% of the U.S. population. I'm also often asked to explain the difference between federal and state sentencing. Under federal law, the sentencing judge must impose a fixed sentence, and there is no parole. The prisoner must serve the entire sentence, but may be given 15% credit for good behavior. The Federal Bureau of Prisons makes the good behavior determination, which is not subject to judicial review. Until the First Step Act was passed, the district judge had a limited role to play in deciding the duration of a prisoner's confinement after the judge imposed the sentence. The states are different. Once a state judge renders a sentence, the judge is usually out of the picture, and parole is the order of the day. On February 26, 2019, the Prison Policy Initiative released a report analyzing the parole release systems of all 50 states and graded them. Its analysis was predicated on statistics and information garnered by the Robina Institute of Criminal Law and Criminal Justice at the University of Minnesota, and the grading was the handiwork of Jorge Reynaud, a Prison Policy Initiative senior policy analyst. As the report first comments, 16 states have abolished or severely curtailed discretionary parole, and the remaining states range from having a system of presumptive parole, where when certain conditions are met, release on parole is guaranteed, to having policies and practices that make earning release almost impossible. Incredibly, only one state received as high as a B rating, 5 states got Cs, 8 states got Ds, and the remaining 36 got an F or F-. This book is divided into 4 parts. The first part tells the stories of 6 representative federal prisoners who had asked me to let them out of jail. Some were serving life sentences for murder. You will learn all about them and the heinous crimes they committed. And at the end of each story, you will wonder what I did. The second part will tell you about the controversial First Step Act and how it has changed the federal sentencing landscape in the United States. The third part will tell you what I did with respect to the 6 prisoners you heard about in the first part. Did I let their original sentences stand, or did I give them a second chance? You will be the judge. But try your best to resist the temptation to go directly from the first part to the third part so that you will understand the First Step Act and why I let some murderers out of jail and not others. In the fourth part, I explain why the state's parole systems have failed us and why the Prison Policy Initiative gave all but one state horrible grades. It will serve as my clarion call to all the states to follow Congress's lead and enact their own First Step Acts. I will also explain the devastating effect that thousands of irrational and unnecessary state and federal collateral consequences have on those released from jail after having served their time, and why most consequences should be eliminated. Surely it is difficult to have much compassion for my representative criminals, especially the mafiosi. But these cases represent the nature of most of the federal compassionate release cases I've had to decide since the First Step Act took effect in 2018. While federal courts, like state courts, handle many less serious crimes, these are typically low-level drug courier cases. Because the sentences for these are usually in the 2 to 3 year range, they realistically are not the subject of compassionate release motions. The typical compassionate release motion entails more serious crimes, which carry far longer jail sentences. In addition to making for captivating listening, the mafia compassionate release stories I tell in this book serve as a template for adjudicating the range of resentencing cases under the First Step Act. They should also have equal cogency for the states that hopefully will follow Congress's lead. An epilogue pulls it all together. Part 1. The Crimes. 1. Justin Volpe. Justin Volpe was a New York City police officer with an unblemished record. Yet in 1999, he admitted to shoving the broken handle of a broomstick up the rectum of an innocent black man, Abner Louima. The case became a national outrage, triggering mass national demonstrations and initiating a rallying cry for police reform. Echoing the national outrage, my late great colleague Judge Eugene Nickerson sentenced Volpe to 30 years after Volpe pled guilty to committing this heinous crime. Never had such a huge sentence been rendered against a police officer for his on-duty conduct. Because of the unprecedented nature of Volpe's criminal acts and the long sentence meted out to a police officer, Judge Nickerson wrote a lengthy opinion explaining why he decided to put Volpe behind bars for 3 decades. He believed that the record before him, including an extensive pre-sentence report from the probation department, was more than adequate to support his factual findings. Judge Nickerson recounted the events. In the middle of the night of August 9, 1997, several New York City police officers, including Volpe, attempted to disperse a large crowd that had gathered outside a nightclub at Flatbush Avenue in Brooklyn. The crowd had become unruly, and Volpe struggled with an intoxicated patron who turned out to be a New York City corrections officer and pushed him to the ground. Admiral Luima came to the inebriated correction officer's aid, but Volpe attempted to push Luima away from the club. Luima was then 29 years old. He had immigrated to the United States from Haiti in 1991 and become a citizen 6 years later. Luima refused to move, and the confrontation escalated. Several police officers approached and tried to handcuff him. At that time, Volpe was struck hard on the side of his head and knocked to the ground. Volpe thought Luima had hit him, but Luima's cousin, Jay Nicholas, was the culprit and had fled after he struck Volpe. The officers, including Volpe, chased the cousin. Volpe believed he was chasing Luima. During the chase, Volpe encountered a totally innocent man, Patrick Antoine, who had not been at the club and was simply on his way home. Volpe yelled at him and began beating him, striking his head and face with a flashlight. The man suffered bruises and contusions on his head and a laceration over his right eye that required 7 stitches. To add salt to the wound, the totally innocent man was then placed under arrest after several other officers arrived. Later that morning, Volpe lied to an assistant district attorney about the Antoine incident. Volpe told the ADA that while he was attempting to place Luima in handcuffs, Antoine pushed and punched him and refused to be handcuffed. Volpe later falsely swore out a complaint charging Antoine with felony assault and other crimes. Luima had been arrested by other officers while Volpe was chasing Luima's cousin. As those officers were driving Luima to the 70th Precinct in their patrol car, they listened to a radio broadcast describing the assailant. The person being described was Luima's cousin, but there was a family resemblance, and the officers mistakenly believed it was Luima. They began beating Luima's body and head, at least once with an unidentified hard object, inflicting contusions and bruises. They then radioed that they had Luima in custody. Volpe heard the report and met the arresting officers on their way to the precinct. Volpe then approached Luima, who was in handcuffs in the back of the patrol car, and beat him on his head and face with a closed fist and a radio. Luima sustained facial lacerations, causing swelling in his mouth and around his eye. The arresting officers then drove Luima to the precinct. Volpe arrived shortly thereafter. Luima was still in handcuffs, and while he was being processed, his pants and underwear fell to his ankles. What happened thereafter haunts me to this day. Volpe saw Luima at the front desk. He then walked to a room where he grabbed a wooden broomstick and broke it over his knees. Luima had in the meantime been taken to the bathroom by the 2 drivers of the car. He was still in handcuffs and his pants and underwear were still around his ankles. Volpe followed him. Volpe then took out the stick and told Luima, "I'm going to do something to you. If you yell or make any noise, I'll kill you." He then pushed Luima to the ground, with his head near a toilet bowl, and forced the broken broomstick approximately 6 inches into Luima's rectum. With Luima crying and in severe pain, Volpe lifted him and put him in a holding cell. A few hours later, Luima and Antoine were taken to the hospital. There, Antoine was stitched up to close his lacerations and was released. But doctors had to surgically repair a 2-centimeter perforation to Luima's rectum and a 3-centimeter perforation to his bladder, as well as perform colostomy and cystostomy procedures. Luima remained hospitalized for the next 2 months. He suffered further intestinal complications requiring emergency surgery and the implementation of a colostomy bag. The bag was removed 4 months later. He thereafter received medical and psychiatric treatment on an outpatient basis and continued to suffer severe headaches, abdominal pain, and insomnia. When then-Mayor Rudy Giuliani was first told of the attack by Charles Campisi, the head of the NYPD's Internal Affairs Bureau, before the news hit the media, the mayor exclaimed, "Oh my God, I can't imagine what that man has gone through." 4 days later, in his Pulitzer Prize-winning report, Daily News columnist Mike McAleary wrote, "This is a tale straight from the police dungeon. An allegation of brutality at the hands of the cops from Brooklyn's 70th Precinct that seems so impossible, so crudely medieval." He quoted Louima as saying from his hospital bed, "The officer said, 'Take this, nigger,' and stuck the stick in." The Louima affair provoked national outrage. 10 days after the attack, an estimated 7,000 demonstrators marched to City Hall in protest and shut down the Brooklyn Bridge and parts of Broadway in Lower Manhattan. The march was dubbed Day of Outrage Against Police Brutality and Harassment. A black New Jersey police officer captured the sentiment of the marchers, telling CNN, "We're here to send a message to America that people of color will not sit idly by when someone is brutalized." Volpe was arrested and charged with a host of violent federal crimes. He chose to go to trial, but 3 days before the scheduled close of oral arguments, after more than 2 weeks of trial testimony and evidence had been presented to a jury, he agreed to plead guilty to the following counts, rather than risk hearing a devastating jury verdict. 1. Conspiring to deprive Louima of his civil rights by aggravated assault and aggravated sexual abuse. 2. Assaulting Louima in a police car. 3. Sexually abusing Louima in the bathroom of the 70th Precinct. 4. Assaulting Patrick Antoine. 5. Falsely arresting Antoine, and 6. Witness tampering. He presumably thought that throwing himself at the mercy of the court would enhance his chances of avoiding a life sentence. In 1984, Congress created a sentencing commission and charged it with creating guidelines for each crime. Each crime carried a certain number of points. For example, the base level for extortion extension of credit was 20 points. Certain enhancements could increase the number, such as if the extortion involved brandishing a gun or if the defendant had acted in a supervisory role. There could also be an offset if the defendant had accepted responsibility instead of going to trial and either pled guilty to the entire indictment or entered into a plea agreement with the government. The base level for being a participant in a first-degree murder was 43 points. Pursuant to these guidelines, the probation department calculated Volpe's total offense level to be 46 points. The guidelines also considered the defendant's criminal history, ranging from a level 1 to a level 6. If the defendant had committed a lot of other crimes, he or she could hit the jackpot at the highest level. A grid would then instruct the sentencing judge of a sentencing range. For example, 17 points with a criminal history of level 3 would carry a range of 30 to 37 months. The judge would then have discretion to fix a sentence within that range after considering the nature of the crime against the defendant's personal characteristics. There were also some limited possibilities of going below the range if, by way of one example, the defendant suffered from extreme mental illness, and the judge could even impose a sentence above the range if the highest criminal history category underrepresented a very bad apple. As for Volpe, since the minimum level for life imprisonment was 43 points, the probation department recommended that a life sentence must be imposed. Judge Nickerson, however, disagreed with that guideline's calculation. He determined that the proper level was 42 points and imposed a sentence of 360 months. Finally, the judge ordered restitution for Louima at $277,495.09. In his opinion, Judge Nickerson commented on the unique depravity of Volpe's heinous crime. Short of intentional murder, one cannot imagine a more barbarous misuse of power. Nonetheless, because of Volpe's status as a police officer, which, when combined with the case's extended national publicity, exposed Volpe to abuse by other prisoners or segregation, Judge Nickerson cut him a break and thought 3 decades of imprisonment were sufficient. Judge Nickerson did not have a reputation as a harsh sentencer, and Volpe's gamble to plead guilty to avoid a life sentence paid off. Judge Nickerson acknowledged, however, that it would be difficult indeed to overstate the harm Volpe inflicted upon Louima and upon society at large. Thus, the judge rejected a host of other arguments that Volpe made for more downward adjustments, concluding that Volpe's sexual assault against Louima was extraordinary because of its violence and its commission by a uniformed police officer against a handcuffed prisoner. Before Judge Nickerson imposed his sentence, he listened to Volpe speak in a packed courtroom, as was Volpe's right. He tearfully pleaded for mercy, apologized to his two victims, and admitted that he indeed jammed a broken broomstick into Louima's rectum, inflicting several internal injuries, because he mistakenly believed that Louima had punched him in the head during a street brawl. He told Judge Nickerson that he was ashamed and deeply regretful for what he did, and added, "I betrayed Abner Louima's rights. I betrayed the city's confidence in police officers. I betrayed myself and my partners, and I betrayed my lawyer." This last reference was because he had not told his lawyer that he was guilty until the trial evidence was overwhelming. What was missing, however, was an acknowledgement by Volpe that even if Louima were guilty of striking him, it would not have justified Volpe's actions at the police station. Volpe's sentence drew sharply mixed reactions. Federal prosecutors said they accepted it, although they had urged Judge Nickerson to impose a life term. Not surprisingly, Volpe's lawyer and father both called it too harsh, while Louima's supporters insisted it was too lenient. Calling the sentence appropriate, Police Commissioner Howard Safer said, "I hope this is a chapter in the history of the NYPD that is behind us." The double entendre was presumably unintended. In an extensive opinion, the Court of Appeals unanimously affirmed Judge Nickerson's sentence, concluding that the district judge did not err. Not surprisingly, the Volpe case attracted a lot of post-conviction media attention. Volpe's mother was quick to point out that one of the most troubling aspects of her son's 30-year sentence was that it came on the same day as a cop killer was sentenced to possible less time. Indeed, Shatik Johnson, 18, who was convicted of the 1999 murder of housing police officer Gerard Carter, known as the Gentle Giant, received a minimum sentence that was 5 years less than Volpe's. Volpe's mother told the New York Post that Johnson killed someone and had a previous homicide and other acts of violence, and my son didn't kill anyone. But in general, the public was puzzled as to how Volpe could do such a horrific thing to another human being. And the psychological pundits had a field day. They pondered whether Volpe could have been the product of a bad neighborhood or a dysfunctional family. But his mother was an artist, as was his father, who became a cop. Volpe grew up comfortably in a middle-class neighborhood on Staten Island, attended a Catholic high school, and graduated from St. John's University. None of Volpe's fellow police officers described the handsome, white, 27-year-old Volpe as an outsider, a reject, a nerd, or any of the things that might drive people to commit hateful crimes. More surprisingly, given the racist language he had used in assaulting Louima, for several years Volpe dated and became engaged to a black female clerk at his precinct. He ultimately married a white woman in 2012 in a ceremony where he was housed at the low-security Coleman, Florida Federal Correctional Facility. Volpe had been on the force for 4 years before his inexplicable crime, had received merit badges for excellent police work, and had never been disciplined for police misconduct. His conduct in brutalizing Louima was aberrational, and why he did that remains a psychological mystery to this day. As for Abner Louima, he sat silently during the sentencing, but he subsequently brought a civil lawsuit against New York City. In 2001, in the largest New York City settlement for police brutality at the time, the city and the police union agreed to pay Louima a total of $8.75 million, of which Louima collected $5.8 million, the rest paid out to Louima's lawyers. Using the settlement money, Louima set up a nonprofit group, the Abner Louima Foundation, dedicated to building community centers in Haiti and for Haitians in the United States, and paid the school tuition for 14 low-income children from the town in Haiti where he grew up. In a 2003 interview, Louima said, "Maybe God saved my life for a reason. I believe in..."
Sample complete. Ready to continue?